Is everyone here? I think so. Begin anyway. So I'd like to start this afternoon. This session is often called the siesta session, by the way, in the trade, and which means that the first sitting after lunch often tends to be a bit soporific. So it's often a good moment to give a talk. Now the theme that I gave for this day was rethinking Buddhism from the ground up, which is more or less the same as the title of the talk last night that some of you attended. Now, why would one want to do that? What's wrong with the way that Buddhism is presented already? Why do we need to rethink it? Well, I think there are a number of reasons. It's certainly not an approach that would appeal or be necessary for everyone who's involved in any way with Buddhism. But I suppose, in many regards, this way of approaching the teachings is something that has become more and more urgent in my own practice, in my own involvement with Buddhism. And over the years, I've become more and more aware that much of what is presented as the Dharma or as Buddhism is really a particular reading or interpretation of earlier canonical texts that has been devised often relatively recently and in most cases at least 1,000 or more years after the Buddha himself. Now, I think that each time Buddhism goes into a new historical or cultural environment, it will be faced with a different set of needs and questions that people will bring to it. That those of us today who are attracted to Buddhism, or Buddhist meditation, or Vipassana, however whichever term we're comfortable with, will find certain elements of the teaching seem to speak very directly to our condition. There's something strangely contemporary and psychologically astute that seems to already be present in many of the ideas and practices that we're presented with as being Buddhist. But at the same time, we may also find there's all kinds of other stuff, ideas, doctrines, beliefs, worldviews, cosmologies, that do not appear to speak very directly to our own condition, but seem to be the legacy of a different world. In some cases, the world, or the worldview, let's say, that existed in the Buddha's time. A cosmology, a sense of how the universe is structured, is created, and so on, quite at odds with how I suspect all of us would now understand the nature of the cosmos from the disciplines of the natural sciences. The Buddhist cosmology strikes us very much as being mythological. I mean, nobody, I suspect, believes that the universe is built around a great big mountain called Sumeru. And the reason the sky is blue is because the side of Mount Sumeru that faces us is made of lapis lazuli. So when the sun passes across it, it creates a blue sky. That's a very beautiful image. It's a lovely sort of mythological way of looking at the world, but it's not one I think anyone in this room is likely to take with any seriousness at all, at least as a description of the world. Most Buddhists today, even in Asia, even traditional Buddhists, are probably comfortable putting that particular belief to one side. What gets more tricky is when we enter into the grey area of certain ideas and teachings that seem to have more to do with what Buddhism is really about. And I'm thinking particularly here of the doctrine of reincarnation, of what happens after death, of how something, Buddhists are very vague as to what that is, continues into another birth, driven by the forces of previous actions committed either in this or in a former life. Now, we can't dismiss this as easily as we can the idea of Mount Sumeru, because we're talking here about something for which there is no hard empirical evidence one way or the other. We're really getting into a territory very similar to that which in the monotheistic faiths would be the question of the existence or otherwise of God. It's very difficult to disprove the doctrine of rebirth and of karmic morality. It's also, of course, very difficult to prove or to demonstrate. So we get into this rather uncomfortable grey area. The vast majority of Buddhists will take for granted that their whole worldview and their whole faith and their practice requires a belief in the continuity of some kind of reincarnating entity over lifetimes. Now, when I published a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs, I suggested that actually we could maybe be agnostic about karma and rebirth. We don't have to affirm them, we don't have to negate them, we can just put them in brackets, keep a question mark over them, and get on with our practice. Now, even such a rather seemingly harmless suggestion did not go down terribly well with the majority of Buddhists, or at least traditional Buddhists. And again, that came as a bit of a surprise to me, because I'd rather hoped that by opening up these issues as things we could discuss and question, which I always thought was something Buddhists were keen on doing, trying to analyze and to look clearly and carefully at what's going on before just accepting something on faith. But this whole, that whole experience made me quite aware that Buddhists were not much different in regard of these sorts of ideas as people of other traditions. And there seems to be, in this regard, something rather fixed, rather non-negotiable about certain of these ideas. I've been told more than once that if I don't accept the doctrine of rebirth and karma, then I can't legitimately consider myself a Buddhist. As easy as that. But at the same time, I do consider myself as a Buddhist. I do consider that my primary orientation in life is one that is informed by the teachings of a man called Siddhartha Gautama. And by putting those values into practice, through meditation, through ethical awareness, through philosophical thinking, I find that this worldview, this template, has enormously enriched my life. So what do I do? Do I follow the party line and say, well, I don't really believe in these things, but they must be true because the Buddha said them? Or do I start looking at things differently? Do I start, as it were, questioning some of the primary traditional assumptions as to what Buddhism is about, and thereby embark on a process of rethinking the tradition? And for better or for worse, that is what my work has become. It's driven very much by a personal sense of urgency to arrive at a degree of coherence and clarity as to what Buddhism is about, not just for my own personal intellectual satisfaction, but equally, and perhaps even more so, because I think there is a great desire and need in the modern world for a Buddhist philosophy or a Buddhist outlook that actually is not in conflict with, let's say, the understanding of the natural sciences. I'm not alone in pursuing these kinds of endeavors, trying to articulate the Dharma in a form that seems to speak more directly and more appropriately to the conditions of our time. As a Westerner, I'm also far more conscious than most traditional Buddhists would ever have been. That Buddhism itself is an historically emerging and transforming and changing phenomenon. In fact, I find it rather bizarre, frankly, that a tradition that emphasizes that all conditions are transient, are impermanent, that all conditions are unsatisfactory, that all conditions are without self, or without essence or identity, permanent identity, that such a tradition could somehow fail to apply its own primary ideas to itself. Everything is impermanent, everything is unsatisfactory, except my particular version of Buddhism. It's a strange business. Buddhism, strangely, does not appear, except perhaps in Zen, to really have evolved a self-critical relationship to its own, towards itself. And I think it's very difficult, from a modern perspective, informed by historical consciousness, to persist that certain doctrines, certain dogmas, certain ideas and practices are necessary, are essential, and have to be preserved in order for Buddhism to survive. In fact, the very notion of preserving the Dharma, the preservation of the Dharma, is itself a very odd idea. Because after all, the only things we preserve are things that are dead, like plums and apples, that we put them into some sort of preserving medium in order to somehow suspend them and hold on to them in order that they can somehow survive. But it's not exactly a metaphor of a vital living tradition. So what I found in my own practice, in my own study, is that my interest has become increasingly one of trying to get back to what some of the core ideas and images that are distinctive to what the Buddha taught, that cannot be derived from the culture or the worldview of his time. This is my sort of starting point and my working hypothesis. What is it about Siddhartha Gautama's teaching that is distinctively his own? In other words, what does he say that we can't, that has not been borrowed or taken over from Brahmanism or the Upanishads or Jainism? What is it that is really original in what the Buddha said? That I find a useful starting point. It clears the ground somewhat. Anything that we could find in the Pali Canon or the early Buddhist texts that we could also find in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we can put that to one side. We can bracket that off. And so this will include the basic worldview of ancient Indian thought, the ideas of rebirth, the ideas of karmic continuity or actions propelling you into another existence, and even the idea that the goal of one's practice or one's spiritual life is the attainment of nirvana, meaning the cessation of the cycle of birth and death. All of these ideas go together. And that model, that template, that framework of ideas is very much that which informs most of the Upanishads. It's very much central to Jainism, it's central to classical Buddhism as well. And yet we find many passages in the early canonical texts that do not seem to sit so happily with that worldview. I think there's a strong case can be made that the Buddha actually regarded the whole question of rebirth and karma as something that really was not of great significance or importance, to the extent that one should simply put it to one side and forget about it. It's irrelevant. And you find this in what are called the unanswered questions. There's a series of questions about whether the world has a beginning or an end, is finite, is infinite, whether mind and body are the same or whether they are two different things, whether one exists after death or whether one does not exist after death. All of these are speculations. And let's face it, these are the basic sort of metaphysical questions that religion often presents itself of being in the business of giving answers to. That's often why we go to a religious authority, is to say, well, what happens after death? Is my mind or my soul, my spirit, the same as my body or not? And the Buddha's saying, don't know that. It's beside the point. What matters is coming to terms with your existence here and now. And the most famous parable in which this point is made is the parable of the arrow, which I'm sure most of you have heard. A man has been struck by a poisoned arrow, is lying on the ground, bleeding to death, and his friends bring a doctor, but the man who's bleeding to death says, hey, wait, only when I know the name of the man who shot the arrow, what kind of bow it was, what kind of feathers were in the tail shaft of the arrow. The Buddha teases this out ad absurdum. Only then will I let you take the arrow out. I think this is a very, very, it's a highly distinctive approach. And it's one, I think, that characterizes what it was the Buddha was doing that was so radical in his time. He was putting aside the questions that had preoccupied the thinkers of the period up to his time, probably many thinkers of his time, and instead presented a teaching that could only really be measured in terms of its value if it worked, if it actually made a qualitative difference to how you experience yourself and your life now, in this world.
Before I forget this reminds me, I think that the question of rebirth is not only the fixed status that the Buddhist has, but the community as people might need some morals, might need some ethics to go along. And I feel like if you take, maybe they feel that as well, if you take rebirth and action, do good and not good, if you take that out and don't believe in it anymore, people might swim morally a little bit more chaotically. It's like taking the Ten Commandments out of the Bible. And maybe that's why these the strict Buddhists, as you call them, like to keep these, to give people guidance of how they should morally, ethically behave with their fellow beings, rather than whether it's true or not. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yeah. And that is correct. You see, most Buddhists, traditional Buddhists, will say, if you remove karma and rebirth, you remove the foundations for morals and ethics. People can just do what they want. Exactly the same arguments were put forward by the Christian churches at the time of the European Enlightenment. If you take out God, the world will just have to become chaos of sin and destruction and evil. People won't have any basis for living a moral life. But in practice, of course, that didn't happen. People are quite capable of leading a moral, ethical life without those metaphysical beliefs. And I don't think by rejecting the law of karma or doctrine of rebirth, you in any sense undermine the ethical precepts at all. But you actually, I think, open them up to be something that is more a tool for living now, rather than some kind of theory of punishments and rewards, which eventually turn out to be motivated by fear, and by a kind of longing or craving to survive into some higher heavenly state. So yes, that would be a counter-argument, but I don't think it's a very convincing one, frankly. Now, let me continue, you can come, but we're going to have a discussion at the end of the afternoon. Now, in terms of these unanswered questions, the ones that I think are interesting are the ones that where the Buddha refuses to say whether the mind and the body are identical or different. He was very prescient in that this is still a big issue. It's called the mind-body problem now. And 2,500 years later, we still haven't figured it out. Maybe we never will. Maybe it's beyond our capacity. But what is curious is that probably from a period quite shortly after the Buddha's death, Buddhists began to have very strong opinions about this. In fact, pretty much every Buddhist school today would adopt a mind-body dualism. Because in order to explain rebirth, you have to have something that's non-material that can survive the breakdown of the physical body. I can't really see how you can have any coherent understanding of continuation of life after death, unless you posit a sort of spiritual entity of some kind. The different Buddhist schools come up with different theories as to what this is, which again suggests that it's a question of speculation rather than any kind of hard empirical evidence. So what's striking in that example is to see how Buddhism, in all of its forms pretty much, has actually gone against what seems to be a very original and very core idea that the Buddha himself taught. It seems a bit odd, frankly. Now, I find, though, that by returning to some of these these parables and metaphors, we can actually begin to rethink the core ideas that underpin not only our theoretical grasp of Buddhism, but perhaps more importantly, our own personal relationship to these teachings and practices. Now, in a recent book by Richard Gombrich, who's one of the really top Pali scholars alive in Oxford, he argues that one of the indicators of something that probably goes back to the Buddha more likely than less likely is when the Buddha speaks in metaphor or in parable. The same has been pointed out regarding the teachings of Jesus. The genius of these teachers was their ability to take an ordinary, everyday, mundane experience and turn it into a teaching device to make a much stronger point. And I think the parable of the arrow is a wonderful example. It's a very simple story, and yet the implications are quite profound. The implications, basically, with the arrow metaphor, are that the Dhamma, or the teaching of the Buddha, is not actually at all interested in ascertaining the nature of reality. Again, most Buddhist traditions will claim that their teachings are founded on a correct understanding of the nature of reality. I don't think the Buddha gave two hoots about the nature of reality, and certainly not in any ontological sense. In other words, this is the nature of being or existence. In fact, the Buddha avoided any commitments to ideas of being or non-being. The parable of the arrow suggests that something very crucial to the Dhamma is its therapeutic and its pragmatic effect. In other words, by following these ideas, by putting these teachings into practice, does that actually have a therapeutic effect on your life? And by therapeutic, I mean healing. The Buddha presents himself very often as a physician, as a doctor. And he talks of the Dharma as a medical treatment. And he talks of the Sangha, the community, as nursing staff. In other words, people who support someone who's sick in their process of healing. And the Buddha, I think, also is what we would call nowadays a pragmatist. Someone who's concerned not with what is true, but is concerned with what works. And by pragmatist, I'm meaning this not just in a general sense, but in the sense that is understood by William James, right up to, more recently, Richard Rorty, the American pragmatic philosophers, who have really abandoned the classical notion of truth, meaning that what is true is what corresponds to some sort of state of affairs in the world. And they've replaced that with the idea of truth being what works in improving and bettering the quality of life. Now, although this way of thinking has been around for more than 100 years, it still probably sounds very alien to many of us. To think of truth as meaning what works, what improves the quality of life on earth. That's true. If something achieves that, we can consider it as true. If it's simply an abstract claim that, you know, emptiness is the ultimate nature of things, which you'll hear from a lot of Buddhists, that's considered to be a kind of a rather pointless statement. How would you demonstrate that in any case? How would you check it? It's somehow getting it all mixed up. It's very, I think, striking too that another prominent Buddhist doctrine that is shared by all the schools today, and I'm sure all of you who've had any dealings with Buddhism are quite familiar with these ideas, the idea that there is a relative truth and an absolute truth, or a conventional truth and an ultimate truth. I was taught this right from the beginning. You'll find it in the Theravada tradition, the Tibetan tradition, the Zen tradition. It's a core, almost axiomatic way in which Buddhists think about the world. There is some deeper truth, some what is called paramattha satya, a truth that is of sort of highest value, that which is really, really true, as opposed to the relative conventional truths of this world. Now, what is striking is that you will not find anywhere in the discourses or the training texts of the Pali Canon a single mention of either of those words. They're just not there. Completely absent. Absolutely absent. Absolutely absent. Not relative. Absolutely absent. They're just not there. So what's going on? Why has Buddhism become founded on what is frankly a rather dualistic view of the world, an ultimate truth, relative truth, where the Buddha never mentioned this at all? So what I find sometimes almost shocking is that ideas that have become commonplace in Buddhist teaching and practice and are assumed to be absolutely central to the whole edifice of Buddhist thought are actually not present in the earliest teachings. And I find that very liberating. So rethinking Buddhism is not just about trying to come up with some new ideas, but it's also about clearing away ideas that have actually come along rather late in the day and yet have achieved the status of orthodox belief. My own view is that the Buddha's understanding of truth is quite close to the pragmatic understanding of truth. When you look at the Four Noble Truths, which of course is the starting point in Buddhism concerning the use of the word truth, he presents the truths not as propositions of fact. This is true. This is true. This is true. But he's saying these four truths are tasks to be performed that will produce an effect in your own life. Now that way of thinking about the four truths, I also think has been somewhat lost. It's quite explicit in the first sermon, particularly. Of the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, very explicit. And yet Buddhism has tended to slip into a kind of correspondence theory of truth. The first noble truth is life is suffering, the second noble truth is the craving is the causing of suffering, and so on. I don't think we have to insist that that is actually what the four truths are about. They're actually more a program for doing something. The first truth is really an injunction to fully know suffering. The second truth is an injunction to let go of grasping and craving. The third truth is an injunction to experience the stopping of craving. And the fourth truth is the injunction to cultivate and to create, to bring into being, bhavana. A way of life, the Eightfold Path. If we start looking at the teaching in that way, we start to get a whole different set of possibilities emerging. In other words, we can, in a way, revive this tradition by breaking it free from what often appears to be a stranglehold of dogmatism, fixed belief, and open up these ideas into therapeutic and pragmatic tools for living. And I don't think, as some of my critics might argue, that somehow trivializes or makes it more superficial. I'm going to have questions at the end. We have, I think, instead, a different kind of template or different perspective within which to pursue our own practice, our own self-understanding, and also a tool whereby to understand what the Buddha's on about. Now, the Buddha, I think, was quite aware that people would very easily get his teaching wrong. And he illustrates this with another beautiful parable. It's the parable of the snake. And I'll read it out. Suppose a man, needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils of its body, or its tail. The snake would turn back on him and bite his hand or arm or one of his limbs. And because of that, he would come to death or deadly suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, here some misguided men learn the Dhamma, but having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with intelligence, and they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Instead, they learn the Dhamma only for the criticizing of others and winning in debates, and they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learned the Dhamma. These teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Now, of course, this is a very problematic text, because who's to say who's got the right grasp? That's not so easy to answer. But I think the important point is that these ideas that the Buddha put forth, he understood as being, in a sense, dangerous, in the same way that a snake is dangerous. If you don't apprehend them or take hold of them or get them in an appropriate way, they could well do more harm than good. You find this, the first time I came across this metaphor was in Nagarjuna, who compares emptiness to a snake. But what he's getting at is actually, he's going back to this metaphor here. The Buddha doesn't use this in terms of grasping emptiness, but grasping the Dharma itself. And the only sort of clue he gives is that what he's warning against, I think quite clearly here, is that you take the Dharma or the teachings of the Buddha and you turn it into a dogmatic system that you are convinced is right. And you then use that as a battering ram against people who don't agree with you. In other words, you become a kind of a dogmatist. You become fixed in your views, and you get very upset when someone says or does something that seems to contradict what you believe. In other words, this is very much the description of orthodox holding on to particular opinions and views. And so the Buddha sees the problem with views and opinions, not just views and opinions that are not Buddhist, but how Buddhism and Buddhist ideas, his own teaching, can become a destructive force if it is misapprehended. So I think this is calling upon anyone who is concerned to take these ideas seriously and to put them into practice, to reflect quite deeply, to consider with as much clarity and critical thought as one can, you know, what is this man trying to say to us? What's going on here? Now, this, of course, is a vast endeavor, because the materials at our disposal are very extensive. Just the Pali materials, 5,000 or 6,000 pages in English. How do we sort out from this welter of sometimes contradictory data, you know, what is it that constitutes the snake? And having identified the snake, how do we then work at handling it in an appropriate way? That is a challenge. And it's a risky business. It's much easier to just sort of believe what the book tells you, or what your teacher or the tradition hands down. That's much more comfortable. But can we nowadays, in all honesty and integrity, just keep repeating opinions and ideas that may have been perfectly compatible with 13th century Tibet or Japan, but don't really fit with the kind of world we live in today? And finally, I'd like to consider another parable that the Buddha used, and I'm sure most of us are familiar with it. And here too, I think we get a very good glimpse of how the Buddha saw his teaching being used. Again, all of the emphasis is on use, handling a snake, removing an arrow. The Buddha's not asking us to adopt a certain opinion. In each of these examples, he's suggesting that we do something differently. And that is where his teaching, I believe, is effective. It can actually make a difference. It can actually change us, hopefully, in a positive way. It can open up the potential of our lives to live more richly and fully and wisely and compassionately. So this is the parable of the raft. Suppose, monks, a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. And then that man thought, well, suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches and leaves and bind them together as a raft. And supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the other shore. And having arrived at the far shore, he might think, gosh, this raft has been very helpful to me. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder, then go wherever I want. Now, monks, what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with a raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with the raft? Having arrived at the far shore, he might think, this raft has been very helpful to me. Suppose I were to haul it onto dry land or leave it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, monks, it is by so doing that the man would be doing what should be done with the raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma, his teaching, is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Now this, of course, this is very similar in a way to the parable of the snake. It has to do with grasping. If you grasp onto this and regard it as the truth, and keep holding on to it even when you don't really need it anymore, it becomes a rather absurd burden. But I suspect many of us have our metaphorical rafts hoisted on our heads and shoulders, and we go through life with all of this great burden of belief and views and opinions and fixed ideas, attachments and so on, that we're not really willing to let go of. Now, what's striking about this metaphor? Well, there's many things striking about this metaphor. First of all, the Buddha's describing someone who's embarking on a journey. A man in the course of a journey comes to an expanse of water. And there's no bridge, there's no boat, and he has to get across. Now, this suggests to me that there's an element of urgency going on here. If the guy had all the time in the world, he could just walk down the bank until he gets to a boat or a bridge and cross it. But no, it's as though we get to points in our lives which we recognize as somehow critical junctions. We may have been living our lives in a perfectly happy and meaningful way, and at a certain point, we kind of run up against a brick wall. We somehow come to a crisis in our existence. It might be in our relationships, in our work, in our whatever it might be. Life is full of these moments I don't have to tell you about. And the task at that point is to find a way to resolve that crisis. And what the Buddha seems to be suggesting in the parable of the raft is there is no kind of a set solution that Buddhism can give you that simply by applying you can solve the crisis. There's no one-size-fits-all Dharma solution. And again, I think we tend to... It's quite easy not to notice that. We're prone, I think, to want to reduce Buddhism to, say, the practice of mindfulness. If I'm mindful, all my problems will be solved. I don't think that's true. And in fact, I don't think you'll find anywhere where the Buddha says it. The Buddha is presenting a range of strategies in his teachings. He traditionally talks of 37 elements or wings or aspects of awakening. 37. Not one. 37. It's a complex task, this practice. And this, I think, is, again, clearly articulated when he says the man thinks, suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, leaves, bind them together as a raft, and supported by the raft, making an effort with my hands and feet, I get across to the other shore. So, if we think of that as a metaphor for how to practice in a given urgent situation, then what the Buddha is suggesting is a kind of bricolage, a kind of collage, that you simply use what materials are at hand. You don't have the luxury in these moments to go off and study the Pali Canon for 2 years before you can deal with your marriage breakdown or whatever it is. You have to use the tools that are available to you in your life at that time. And the way he describes these tools are not as holy teachings, but as grass, twigs, branches, leaves. The only thing that matters is whether the material floats. Everything else is relevant. So again, we come back to this pragmatic approach. It's what works to get that vehicle across the river. And anything will do. Nowadays we use old plastic water bottles, bits of polystyrene packaging, anything. The only thing that matters is that it floats. And you can bind it together and you can use it as a raft to get you to the other side. Now this, I think, is also suggesting quite strongly how each person, each practitioner, is responsible for cultivating a practice of the Dharma in a way that is appropriate to their particular situation. The Buddha doesn't say, well, go to the, the man will say, I need to find someone who knows how to make rafts or boats to tell me what to do. No, you're in a situation, and we're in these situations all the time, of conflict, of strife, of crisis. You use and can only really use what you have got to hand. And it may be, in our modern times, that we might take bits and pieces from Buddhism. We might borrow some ideas from psychology, or philosophy, or some other sort of therapy or something. It doesn't really matter. The point is, does it get us across the river? And once we've got to the other side, to be able to say, well, that was helpful there, I can put it aside now, and then continue on my journey. Now this is a key passage. He says, so it would be more wise to leave the raft on the dry land, leave it in the water, and then go wherever I want. Now this again is, it struggles with the classical interpretation of this parable. The classical interpretation is that the near shore of the river is samsara, the far shore of the river is nirvana. That's usually how this is presented. And once you get to nirvana, then you don't need to keep carrying the Dharma around with you. But that's a rather final goal. The Buddha doesn't say when you get to the far shore, the journey's over. In fact, he says when you put down what you were using then, and you carry on with your journey. So the way this metaphor is framed is that he's portraying life as a journey which is periodically hitting bodies of water that have to be crossed, or simply obstacles, blocks, crises that need to be resolved in order that you continue. So once again, we have a notion of a practice that is pretty much open-ended and ongoing as long as we're alive. Life will constantly throw up challenges to which we will, no matter how much insight we've gained in meditation, we will have to seek to resolve in a way that cannot be simply solved by rote or by some acquired belief in the efficacy of this, that, or the other meditation, let's say. We have to get ourselves together in such a way that we can resolve that particular crisis. And that's the practice. And so the Buddha says in conclusion that I've shown you how the Dharma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. In other words, the Dharma, the teaching, the practice, is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. It's a strategy. It's a tool. It's a device. It's a skill. But in itself, it has no intrinsic value. Its only value lies in its ability to solve a particular problem in your life. Now, these parables, these stories, which I hope, and last night we looked at the parable of the city, which I think is very much in the same kind of metaphorical vein. These images are quite compatible one with the other. And they help us, I think, or they provide us, or I found that they provided me, with very rich metaphorical resources to be able to imagine more creatively, perhaps, what it is that this practice is about. And so when I talk of rethinking Buddhism from the ground up, I'm concerned to go back to what I would consider to be foundational. And I think these metaphors, city, snake, raft, arrow, are four very good examples. To me, these are really pretty much fundamental images on the basis of which we may be able over time, possibly together, to imagine a way of practicing, a way of thinking about Buddhism that's very much rooted in its own ideas, its own images, but is able to be rethought, reimagined in a way that speaks to our condition and our world today. And I think Buddhism has always done this. I don't think it's anything new. Each tradition in the past that has found some form, some value, has basically arisen out of certain figures, teachers, being able to appropriately imagine another way of doing it. So I'm going to stop there. what I'd like to do is have a period of sitting and a period of walking, and then at 4:15 to open up the whole space for discussion, questions and answers, so that we conclude in a more interactive way. But I think it would be helpful now if we walk for 20 minutes until 3:15, and we come back here for a final sit at 3:15, and then at the end of that sit, we'll continue with the discussion. Is that okay? Okay. So, Jackie, could you ring the bell at 10:10? Thank you. Ladies just gone out to the loo. Both have to come back. I'd like to just suggest, if you haven't heard of this book, that you might enjoy it. Has anyone seen this? It's called Teach Us to Sit Still by Tim Parks. It's really, really good. It's one of the best accounts, not only in terms of sort of insight, but also in terms of literary quality, that I've come across, that talks about a man's struggle with pain, specifically prostate pain, that leads him eventually to do Vipassana meditation, exactly the sort of practice we've been doing here. And it's very beautifully written, very touching, very moving. You can get it anywhere. Unfortunately, it's difficult. It's really a work of literature, but it's being packaged as a self-help book, which it's not. So it's maybe tricky to find. They have them in, I got this one in Waterstones in town. They have them in the 3-for-2 section in front. Okay, this is our last 45 minutes or so, and I'd like it to be an open session. Anything that I've said or anything you have come up with in your own meditation today or elsewhere, then we can talk about it. I'm going to try and keep my answers brief so that more people than less will be able to ask something, but I'm not very good at that. Yes.
Stephen, one of the things you said today is that the truth has been changed over the years by travel through cultures. You can see that fairly easily when you travel into Southeast Asia, Thailand, going northeast, where you see that Thailand is just the Buddha, and as you go further northeast, there begins to get more and more demigods associated with them. And what you are suggesting for Buddhism is not that, also not true of both Islam and Christianity, in that the original truth has been corrupted over a period of time by the priest class, who initially went forward to spread the truth, but as time passed they got dragged into the political arena and created the dogmas which were used in the political arena.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. And in fact, I went to have lunch yesterday with Don Cupid, and he was saying exactly the same thing about Christianity. The religion seems to have a very, almost a built-in tendency to get drawn into being a branch of, the moral branch of whatever political regime is. They used to call the Church of England the Conservative Party of Prayer. But I'm also a little reluctant to use words like corruption. Because if we, as I was saying in my talk, if we think of what is true as what works and has benefit in a particular situation rather than what corresponds to the truth, then I think we have to acknowledge that in different cultures and different times, different forms of belief, different forms of practice, different philosophical outlooks, given the nature of those societies, are going to be more or less effective. So I'm a little reluctant to sort of take our current modern scientific worldview as somehow the truth, or somehow normative, and then to judge negatively any historical tradition or teaching that doesn't live up to the sort of standards we want today. I don't think that's very helpful. And at the same time, I do agree with you. I think Buddhism has historically tended to become allied with often rather conservative and autocratic systems of power, much as the churches have in Europe. And Buddhism also hasn't undergone a reformation, and not to the extent that we find Christianity, for example. And so it's not had a kind of a rupture within itself of a comparable gravity. And to that extent, the Buddhism we get in the West today is, by and large, still very much speaking a language that is addressing people in very, very different situations to our own. Some of those teachings will be very effective, others much less so. And I mean, I know from my own people who write me emails and letters and stuff, there's a lot of people out there. Tim Parks, this is actually quite a good example, actually, who doesn't like Buddhism much at all from what he knows about it, but he finds that the practice works. And what's great about this book is he has real serious dukkha going on in his body, and he wants to deal with it. Medical science doesn't work. Alternative therapies to an extent. But what he finds actually works is a radical transformation of his relationship to pain, his own pain. And that is that to me is really very much at the core of what the Buddha was teaching. Something that really does make a difference. But yeah, you're right. And I don't see that there's any way of safeguarding against such problems or corruptions, as you put it.
Distortions,
yeah. But again, distortion implies that there is some kind of normative reality or truth. I'm a little bit suspicious of that. I think, I'm not so sure. Yes.
Two of my sort of precious things in a way when you talked about absolute truth and relative truth and emptiness, that's right. Because the way I see absolute and relative is that from what I understand, the human mind is liable to distort perceptions in so doing. What it conceives is relative. It's not actually clear seeing. Mm-hmm. Absolute truth would be clarity of seeing. That brings me to that quote from St. Paul about now you see through a glass darkly, then face to face. And I just put those two together and say, okay, yeah. Because every animal on the earth has a different perceptory system. Mm-hmm. It therefore sees things slightly differently. So there is a relative and there is an absolute.
Well, you see, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, that is, it is a very compelling theory. But I'm reluctant to affirm. I really don't get it. Why this, I mean, for a start, absolute is completely an inaccurate translation.
Probably, yes.
It's not what the word means at all. The word means, paramatta means highest meaning, truth, literally. Highest meaning, truth. But the word is artha, which means meaning. Now you could, if I were to look at it sympathetically, this doctrine, which I don't, paramatta would be, could be interpreted pragmatically. In other words, what way of seeing the world helps you realize what you value the most? And that makes it pragmatic. What way of seeing things helps you realize what you value the most, what your param arta, your highest values are. If we look at it that way, I don't have so much of a problem with it. In contrast to the various negotiations and dealings we have to do with simply negotiating our way in the world, those are relatively true and false things. But what, if you look at it that way, you could give it some credence. The problem with it, though, is that it sets up a dualism. Almost unavoidably, I think, that there is something which is really real and something which is only relatively or conceptually real. And that distinction, I think, is alien to the Buddhism as presented in the Pali Canon. It's much closer to exactly the way of looking at the world the Buddha rejected, namely the Brahmanic model, where you do there have an absolute truth. It's called Brahman, or Atman, or Purusha, some ultimate value that does not depend on any other conditions whatsoever apart from itself. That really is absolute truth, God, basically, as opposed to the illusory Maya, the illusory world that we live in that is actually deceptive and distorted and so forth. And yet somehow behind that distorted perception lies some kind of pure, unblemished, absolute reality. Now, if you think of it in those terms, you've actually reverted to the language of the Upanishads. And what we in fact you find throughout what we would nowadays loosely call the parental philosophy. It's a very attractive, it's intuitively compelling. We live in a world of, like Paul said, we see things through a glass darkly, but at some point we'll see things face to face. But I'm just not comfortable with making that split. Certainly there are ways we see and that relate to the world that are more or less helpful in realizing our goals. If we want to achieve well-being and fulfillment and flourishing in our lives, then it will help to look at the world in a certain way to achieve those goals. But I don't think we have to thereby claim that, you know, the way that the Buddha teaches or Christ teaches, that that points to the real reality, whereas everything else is distorted. I don't see it that way. Can we have another question? Otherwise we're going to get carried away off on. What's your question?
It's not a question.
Oh, good.
It's a thought.
Tom, you.
I had about things you said. Karma. Whether your action, because you said maybe it's not so important. From my personal experience, when I first came in contact with Buddhism, uh-huh. I was only used to kind of the Christian doctrine of which was very authoritarian of the goodies and the baddies and what to do and what not to do. And I've had tremendous liberation, relief, and maybe even healing in suddenly having a philosophical idea telling me actually it's my own decision. And if I want to club someone with a club over the head and be all bad, that's fair enough. I'm going to get it back, but I have that choice. And I felt really kind of liberated. There's not some kind of force up there that kind of controls what I should do or judges what I should do or not. It's kind of for myself. I do it, does it make sense? Not for myself. I do it for my own good. Yeah, I can decide. Mm-hmm. I have it, so it attracted me. And then when I moved on, it became less and less important. I thought it doesn't really matter whether it exists or whether reincarnation exists, because I find out when I do something nice, actually I feel quite well. I actually feel quite good. And so that gives me now the inspiration to do good, because I've experienced that I usually, not always, and get something good back. So maybe even the belief in reincarnation or in karma at a certain development stage can be very healing and very good. And then about fear, because I really oppose this kind of fear that Christianity has. But maybe even fear can be useful. Like if you have a toddler and you teach him to fear the road, otherwise he's going to get run over because he doesn't know yet. Maybe if someone has not a very highly developed mental institution, if you teach him that it's not good to kill and it's not good to do certain bad things, in a fearful way, until he develops, he can grasp that maybe it's not good. It's not always bad either, maybe.
I agree. If we take a pragmatic reading of reincarnation and karma, in other words, to get out of the habit of thinking, is it true or is it false? Does this theory correspond to reality or not? That's a dogmatic perspective. If we think of it as a pragmatic thing, then under certain circumstances, in certain cultures, at certain times, this way of thinking about the world might have been the best theory on offer. And in terms of your own example, that I agree, I think that a doctrine such as this may actually help liberate you from something that's more harmful. Certainly. I think that's true. My problem with it is when the law of karma just means action. The law of karma, or karma vipaka, means a system of moral belief that maintains that if you commit a certain act, then you will reap a specific consequence, either in this or in a later life. And consequently, whatever we experience here and now is also the consequences of actions that we have committed, either earlier in this life or in a previous life. That's basically what they're saying. Now, in some ways, it's liberating. And in fact, a lot of the ways traditional Buddhists present the doctrine of karma now is very much in the way you describe it. It's not about a fatalism. It's actually saying you have the freedom to make choices that will have positive or negative consequences in your life. That can be very liberating. But unfortunately, there's more to it in the classical doctrine. Because it also, and this is where it gets problematic, for example, if a person is born handicapped, or a child is born with spina bifida or something, then that is the child's fault. I doubt you'd be so comfortable with that view. The handicapped person is handicapped because of something they did in a previous life, and they have to now live that out. If you have such a view, you're not going to have a strong impetus to try to actually understand why a child would have spina bifida, or how you could actually work as a community to make that person's life as good as possible. So there are positive and negative things in any kind of theory. And I think the karmic one has both a bright side and a dark side. But again, if we go back to some of these earlier texts, we find the Buddha speaking about karma in a very different way. For a start, this is fairly well known. When the Buddha is asked, what is karma, he almost invariably says, it is intention. Which comes back to your point. It's the choices, the decisions that you make that prompt you to say or do something that will then have consequences. That, I have no problem with that at all. I think that's almost common sense, actually. I don't think it's making a grand claim. And I think that is a sound basis for a moral life. Whether or not you believe in reincarnation, I think that is a very useful way to think. I have no problem with that at all. What I have a problem with is when the doctrine of karma is raised up effectively to the status of some sort of god. In other words, the belief that many Buddhists would hold that the way the world is the way it is, the reason why the world is the way it is because of the collective actions of the beings who currently inhabit it. Now that is a theory of creation. And I don't think the Buddha ever said that. So you have to, I think, to some extent, have a rather discriminating view on these various ideas. And I think we have to not, I think it's a mistake to sort of make a, sort of condemn certain doctrines as somehow either wrong or not useful. We often have to pick them apart and find what makes them up and what bits of it will help and what won't. That's my take on it. Yes.
I was very struck by what you said at one stage about being mindful of things in the past.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could clarify, is it our own personal past, or is it great thinkers and great philosophers? And how do we do it?
Well, I think both, really. I think in the context of the text I read, as I would understand that passage, it would refer to being mindful of something like the Dharma, what the Buddha taught, the whole overall vision of the kind of life that we aspire to, qua Buddhist, if we're Buddhist. So in that sense, it does imply recalling the Buddha. It also, if we think of it in terms of a moral identity, then it's recalling the sort of person recalling the sort of person you think you should be. Let's say, for example, a lot of what Buddhists would call unskillful actions are things that we do that we know in ourselves are things that would not reflect well on us were they widely known. In other words, if you're a monk, one of the things you're mindful of is the fact that you're a monk. The fact that you stand for a certain tradition, you embody certain values. And so I can easily think of someone saying, in advice to another monk, for example, be mindful of your vows. Be mindful that you're a monk. Be mindful that you're a representative of the Buddha. Be mindful of the fact that you are a husband. Be mindful of the fact that you're a father. In other words, you are mindful of those identities you have that you value. And so mindfulness is more than just being attentive to the breath or the sensations of the body, whatever. It's being mindful of what it is you value. And if you look at the very end of the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the practice of mindfulness, the final thing to be mindful of in what's called the fourth Satipatthana, the mindfulness of the Dhamma, is the Four Noble Truths. Being mindful of the Four Noble Truths, what does that mean? I think it means to recollect or to hold in mind, not necessarily consciously, but to the extent to which you have internalized these values, is holding them in mind. Holding in mind what sort of person you aspire to be, you would seek to be in the world. And I think it has a strong moral dimension to it. So on the one hand, yes, it's being mindful of what you have consciously sought to realize in your life as considered good. And also, if you're a Buddhist, then also to recall and to remind yourself of the exemplary figures in your tradition, let's say your teacher, a teacher or whatever, and ultimately the Buddha himself. If you're a Christian, it would be obviously with Christ and the apostles and various people in that tradition. And I think we do that anyway. I think that's how human beings operate morally, as moral agents, is to somehow have a picture and to retain and remember that picture as they enter into, let's say, morally ambiguous situations and have to make choices. That's how I would understand.
I was thinking, following on from that, I wanted to say a little bit more about what you were talking about last night about the Buddha's metaphor of the city. Mm-hmm. Because I was wondering what the implications would be for us in our lives of living a life where the encouragement was to renovate a city as well as all the other parts.
Some of you weren't here last night, so maybe briefly just put that into context. There's another parable I talked about last night, which is the parable of a man who goes into a forest and finds a ruined pathway covered with foliage. And he follows this ruined pathway, and he arrives at the ruins of an ancient city. And then he goes to the king, and he appeals to the king to renovate the city. And the king and the ministers and everybody gets together. They rebuild the city so that once again it is flourishing and it is prosperous. Now when the Buddha explains that parable, he says that the path that he comes across in the forest is the Eightfold Path. And the city is the Four Noble Truths. So what the parable points to is that the way of the path, the Eightfold Path, cannot be understood adequately just as my own personal spiritual journey. But the Eightfold Path is one that inevitably brings us into an awareness that we are acting and we're living and we are participants in a wider community, those who, as it were, share those common values. And the realization of the city really is, I think, the encouragement to create a community. On the one hand, I think we shouldn't take this too literally. I don't think it's about going out and building a new Jerusalem. But it's about building community, and also, very importantly, trying to instill another kind of culture. I would see it rather as culture than civilization. I think it's a little bit too grandiose to think that, you know, my practice is going to lead to a new civilization. But it certainly can contribute to the hiding of a heightened awareness in the community of other ways of living, other forms of value, other kinds of ways of doing, say, leading one's moral and spiritual life. It's not just a solitary process, but something that seeks to realize those values in the shared world of society. So that's how I would see it.
So it's an internal city, so much as an
I think it's both.
Right.
I think it has to be both. And I think what it points to, which I feel today is a rather important point, is it points to how one's practice is not, it's not an either or exercise. It's not a question of is my practice just about sorting out my own inner life? Or am I an self-avowed, engaged Buddhist who goes off and, you know, plants trees in Scotland and does all sorts of good works in society? I think that distinction is problematic. I don't like the term engaged Buddhism. It somehow implies that there's a disengaged Buddhism, which I think historically there has been. But rather than sort of posit a kind of counterweight to a rather self-indulgent spirituality by saying, no, we've got to be involved in the world, if we go back to the earliest sources, we find that split is simply not made. In other words, engaged Buddhism is a response to a distortion within the evolution of Buddhism in Asia. It's a corrective movement. But it sets up again a duality, engaged, not engaged. Whereas if we go back to something like the metaphor of the city that the Buddha presented, or even the very, you just think about the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is neither something purely internal, nor is it something just to do with relationships with others. It's both. The way you see, think, speak, act, work, you can't do that without a context, without others, without community.
The city feels like a place that you arrive in. You know, almost like a...
Well, it does, but you see, the Buddha's not actually talking about arriving in a city, he's talking about building a city.
Or renovating something.
Renovating, as we looked at last night, is a bit problematic, I agree. I think we can drop the idea of renovating. Whether you're starting from scratch or whether you're inspired by some example in the past, the point that the actual task at hand is to build something.
So it's all process.
Really. It's process.
Yes, both the path and the
But it is a process that envisions some kind of culture, some kind of world, not just a practice that envisages me becoming enlightened.
Are the Buddha's moral teachings only pragmatically true?
Pragmatically true?
Yes, in the sense that they allow one to live a fulfilled or...
Well, I would take it that way, yes, but So I think the basis of Buddhist morality is very similar to the basis of Christian morality, actually. And I've got some quite good quotes about that. I mean, this is Sutta Nipata, verse 705. the Sutta Nipata, remember, is considered both by scholars and by traditional Buddhists as the earliest stratum within the Pali Canon. So it's the earliest of the earliest. And this is the Buddha saying, as I am, so are they. As are they, so am I. Comparing oneself with others, one should not kill or cause to kill. Now this is basically do unto others as you have to do yourself. And it's so strikingly similar. And yet it's at least 400 years prior to Christianity. And I think it really is, it's not an exclusively Buddhist or Christian idea. I think human thought, when it reaches a certain degree of clarity in any culture, will, I think, come up with some kind of notion such as this. You'll find this in many traditions. But I don't think Buddhism has got a particular Buddhist morality in that regard. I think the difference might be that are the methodologies of consciousness that the Buddhists teach that will perhaps sensitize us far more to the kinds of suffering that others have and that we have, that will perhaps allow us a greater sensitivity towards the suffering we cause others, the suffering we cause ourselves, our sense of the other person and his or her well-being or lack thereof, which comes back again to what Jackie was saying, that the practice has to be one that is embedded in our relationships with others. That's very clear. And I think Buddhism has lost sight of that over time. I think Mahayana Buddhism was again an attempt to correct a distortion that crept in, a rather self-centered spirituality about becoming liberated and really not being so concerned about others. And yet, we don't have to go to Mahayana texts to find... in fact, we don't find these sorts of ideas very much in Mahayana texts. I think you get a... Again, it's a bit of a trawl going through these materials to stumble across these little kind of gems. But I think what I've done here is I've compiled basically all of the bits of the canon that suit me. if you want a copy of this, by the way, I'm going to post it on my website at some point. But if you go to the website and send me an email saying, please send the citations, I'll just send it to you, if you're interested. But this is an ongoing project. But that's how I would see Buddhist morality. Yes?
I just wanted to follow up on what Jackie was saying about the city. Different point.
Okay.
From reading your book, there's a point where you say that the Buddha had to go to the king and engage with the existing power structures, which were certainly not perfect, and, to some extent were quite conflictual and not sort of the ideal that we might imagine for ourselves. And I found that point really comforting, because I sometimes feel like, we live in such an imperfect world, and the more mindful you are, the more I think you can become aware that things don't work well and there's so much suffering. And for some reason, I found that point very... the fact that the Buddha was engaged in the world, and he didn't take himself off, and there's the monastic stuff, which is a bit, I guess, removing yourself from the world. But that fact that the Buddha kind of worked with the king and had to engage with the existing power structures made me feel much better about kind of continuing my own life in this world that troubles me a lot sometimes. And that you make that point quite nicely, and I just remember taking that away because it made me feel much better.
Thank you. Well, I'm very glad to hear that, actually, because that's precisely the point I'm trying to make. In this book I've just written, Confession of a Buddhist Atheist, the two-thirds of the book is about my reconstruction of the Buddha's life. And what I do is to try to embed the story of the Buddha within the social, economic, political, and religious context in which he lived in the 4th century BC in India. And what we see, and this is, again, these materials are all within the canon, they're not later additions. They represent what I feel is quite probably close to the actual historical story, as far as we can know. But what it shows is that the Buddha was not living this detached existence in these rather nice monastic communities, but he was continuously having to interact and negotiate and deal with some really quite unpleasant people. As you say, in societies that were far from perfect. And I find that too gives the Dharma a kind of a hard edge that I can relate to in terms of my own life. I don't have to think of the Buddha as this sort of rather impossibly perfect person, but rather this was a man like you and I who had to, in order to achieve his goals, namely to establish the Sangha and the Dharma on earth, he had to compromise with the powers of the world. And towards the end of his life, the whole thing came crashing down. That all of his patrons died or were killed, and he was basically, I think the last 3 or 4 years of the Buddha's life, was spent kind of in exile. And the last year or so of the life is very tragic. Very, very tragic. And in a way, it's a bit like the Passion of Christ, in a way. And in a strange way, the Buddha's death could be seen as a tragedy, but paradoxically, it's also a triumph, because in the end, his teaching did survive. And although I suspect he might have had considerable doubts about whether it would have done under those circumstances. Yes.
I'm not sure if you'd say a bit more about the mind-body problem mentioned at the beginning. And in recommending Tim Park's book, I mean, it sounds like you're talking about how the practices can be used to be as close as possible to levels of pain which stop it hurting so much, or less aversion to it. It can be really engaged with an ailing body. In a very interesting and, well, engaged way, transformative potential. But when you said the body-mind problem, you were talking about death, weren't you? Say a bit more about that.
Well, what's striking in the Pali materials is that the Buddha does not speak in terms of body and mind. In fact, he uses these rather curious ways of describing the human situation. The most famous of which is the five skandhas.
Mm.
Why five?
Yes.
Five skandhas. When I first came across that, it was like, what's going on? Why five skandhas? And it was 12 ayatana, it was 18 dhatu.
Yeah.
What's striking about the Buddha's teaching, there's four truths, you see. And if you go into each truth or each skandha, it breaks down even further. The Buddha's teaching seems to be a concerted effort to move away from any kind of monistic interpretation of reality. It's a pluralistic vision. He's constantly teasing out diversity and difference. And he's not either reducing the whole of reality to being matter or mind, and he's certainly not talking of being mind and matter being in some sort of conjunction, one versus the other. But rather, he's talking more and more about the extraordinary complexity of the world. Now, again, I've got passages in here that illustrate this rather well. Consciousness 23. Now, this is Sati, the fisherman's son, who's a monk. Marjana, middle-length saying, discourse number 38. And Sati, the fisherman's son, comes to the Buddha and says, as I understand the Dharma taught by the Buddha, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another.
Oh, yes.
Right? And the Buddha says, what is that consciousness, Sati? And Sati says, it's that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there as the result of good and bad actions. Sounds like classic Buddhism. Buddha says, misguided man. To whom have you ever known me to teach the Dharma in that way? Misguided man, in many discourses have I not stated consciousness to arise upon conditions, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. Monks, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent upon the eye, and shapes and colours, it's reckoned as eye consciousness, etc. Just as fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns. When fire depends on logs, it's called a log fire, etc. Now this is a view of consciousness which is neither materialistic or spiritualist. He's basically saying that consciousness is the consequence,
the result of
an organism encountering an environment. And consciousness is what happens when these two complex conditions impact. Then you have consciousness. Take either of those conditions away, no consciousness. Now that's a view that's very similar to a view expressed in a recent book by the neuroscientist Albert Noe called Out of Our Heads, which which is basically making exactly that same point. The consciousness will never be found in the brain somewhere, nor is it something sort of free-floating, independent of the body. But consciousness is an emergent property of an organism interacting with an environment.
And also something that can be developed, I mean, in a way that's...
Yeah, that's it. I mean, this is something that can be cultivated, that can be developed, but and it does have to do with death, too. Because if that is the nature of consciousness, then when the body dies, what is there that could then emerge out of an interaction to continue? And that, this does not sit happily at all with the doctrine of a reincarnating consciousness. In fact, the Buddha says, you know, Sati says, the consciousness runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth. He says,
But it can be taken up with someone else, can't it?
Sorry?
It can be, perhaps, I mean, the engagement through consciousness between people, if you're having that, that can continue.
Yes, but you and I won't be around to witness it. I mean, yes, of course. I mean, this is the thing also with karma. Of course, our actions have consequences. And if I drop dead tomorrow, that doesn't mean that the consequences of my actions will not continue. They will. I mean, things I've said, books I've written, for example, you know, they're going to continue to irritate people long after I'm dead. So I don't think you need to believe in a separate consciousness that goes from life to life, in order to recognize how what we do now, our acts, both individually and collectively, will have consequences after our death. And that is, in a sense, what really matters. Are we going to leave this world in a worse place than when we were born? And if so, we're not acting compassionately or responsibly for those who will come to live here after we're gone. And I don't think you need... That's enough. You don't need, you know, consciousness is sort of squiggling through from dead bodies to wounds. It's unnecessary. Got 2 minutes to go, or should we wind up now?
There's one more question, if I may.
Quickly, yes.
Yes. So in different traditions, people say you shouldn't go and mix and match and go to Buddhism and pick out what you like because that suits you, and then you go to Christianity and then you take what you like there, maybe the angels and Jesus, and then you go to, I don't know, to the Muslim place and you'd like to prostrate because that's good for your body. Because they say that if you are not that enlightened or you conscious not so well, you will always pick what suits you, might not necessarily be what's good for you. Therefore, it might be good to stick with one of these things so that you don't always stop at your own hurdle because you can't even see there is one. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes sense. This is a common argument.
Because I like to pick and choose.
And if you look at the parable of the raft, it's basically about picking what works. You see, I think we may be going beyond, I hope, I don't see much evidence for it, to be honest. But I would like to envisage a future in which, you know, mass movement, institutional religions are not, are able to claim the sort of authority they claim now. I think we get infantilized by these kind of teachings. Because, you know, it's all very, exactly, you know, you mustn't pick and choose because, you know, you may not choose what's really good for you. Who knows what's really good for you? Who's the? Why should the rabbi or the Buddhist monk or the imam know what's good for you?
But I do sometimes know what's good for my children, even so they can't see that at that point.
Well,
but they might still need the experience.
Okay, fair enough. So I'm not discounting the fact that it is valuable to spend time studying respectfully with people who know more than yourself. Obviously. And if you look at the way the Buddha set up his monastic training, he encouraged a young monk or nun to spend around 5 years with a preceptor. But once they had, you know, basically got the basic teaching and had established a kind of practice for themselves, they ought to become autonomous and go off, as you said, go forth into the world for the welfare of the many, for the benefit of the many, and let no two of you follow the same path.
But you know what that makes me lonely? Well, because if we have...
No, it's true.
If you pick and choose, you're not home anywhere. And if you want to live in a sangha, then it's easier if you have similar beliefs. But if I go into a church who preaches that if I don't do this and this, I'm going to be the sinner, but there's a lot of nice other teaching of Jesus that I'm enjoying, I don't feel completely part of that community. I cannot share all that faith completely. But then I go into a Buddhist group and I think, oh, but when I meditate, I really like to imagine that Jesus is coming and showering me with his nice energy. And I don't really feel like I want to share this either, because I think that's probably something I'm a complete Christian nutter. So it makes... if you choose and pick and build your own float, then there's lots of people who...
Well, I agree. I think that, again, with this, we have to find the sort of middle way. Mm-hmm. I think the way you've described it is a little extreme. I doubt there are that many people who would literally go to Christian church one week, Muslim mosque the next. I think that's going a bit far, because you do, I agree with you, I think having a sense of belonging to a community of shared ideas and values is rather important. And that might mean having to identify yourself as a Christian or a Buddhist, because those are large frameworks of more or less consistent values and ideas. And there you'll find a sense of participation in community. So, yes, I agree with that. But again, the other extreme is that so easily does a religious community become closed-minded, become exclusive, become superior to others. And I don't particularly want to go there, and I doubt you do. I think, again, I mean, Buddhism, in a way, is about finding a middle path. It's about finding a way in which we don't get stuck in one kind of extreme or another. So there's one extreme would be pure eclecticism. Anything goes. The other extreme would be very sort of sectarian, rigid, closed-minded fanaticism. That's not going to work either. We need to find a way, I think, especially in the plural, complex, multicultural societies in which we live, in which we are able to celebrate diversity and recognize value in other traditions, and yet also be grounded in and faithful and true to a framework of thinking and practice that really speaks to our heart. That would be my suggestion. But again, that's a way of thinking about religion that's quite new. The traditional religions just don't, you know, they're not welcoming of that kind of thinking. The Quakers, for example, might be an exception. But that, I feel, is the way we need to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think Liz has something to say.
And the first thing to say is thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful, rich afternoon. I'm sorry it has to end.
Everything has to end.
Thank you so much for coming from all of us. Just some announcements for everybody. I also want to thank Jackie very much. She's done a lot today. And also Ernie, Anne, and Winnie, and I think there are a few other people who helped us. So many thanks to everybody, because this day worked really well, and we really appreciate everybody's presence and participation. It's really been a nice day. So thank you, all of you. Our next retreat is the 4th of December. So there's a little bit of a gap. But then we have three in rapid succession. There's also one in January, I think. So the 4th of December is Christina Feldman, and the same usual organization applies. You can send me a check anytime if you want to pre-book. We want to invite everybody downstairs for a cup of tea, and I heard there might even be biscuits today. So please come downstairs for a cup of tea. And we all love the silence, of course, but it's wonderful to meet each other and speak at the end of the day. So if you have time, please come downstairs and have a cup of tea. I have to come back up here around 5 to rearrange the room for the friends. Could a couple of people join me to just move some chairs around? It should give us plenty of time for tea, and then we'll just move the chairs. Take about 10 minutes. A couple of people? Any? Joanna? Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. And finally, the sort of last thing I speak about, which is probably one of the most important parts of the day, is to speak about Donna. Many of you know about this, but I know there's some new people here. Dana is a tradition that goes back to the time of the Buddha. The teachings of the Buddha were seen as priceless, and they were offered by the monks and nuns, offered freely to anyone who wanted to hear them. And in return, people would support the monks and nuns. And this is a tradition that continues today in the Insight tradition. So all of the teachers of Gaya's, including Stephen, don't receive a salary or a stipend for the work that they do. They come here and offer their knowledge and their the teachings freely to us. And in return, we're invited to offer Dana to them. And the Dana box at the back is our way of really supporting the teachings and making sure that Stephen can continue this work and is coming here and teaching us. So in a very practical sense, the Dana is a very important part of this day in the sense that it allows us to have these retreats. So that's sort of the first point about Dana. The other points about Dana that I like to make, I think, are just things to reflect on. And the first one is that I think it's just a really wonderful way for us to express our appreciation to Stephen for all of the thought and the care that he puts into planning the day and the presentation, and also for his willingness to fly all the way from France. It's a long trip, and he just comes for the weekend. So I think, you know, it's a very kind of tangible way for us to express our appreciation for the wonderful things that we've learned today. I think all of us feel, you know, just a sense of having a much wider knowledge of the Buddha's life than we did before. So expressing our appreciation is the first thing. The second thing is just that I think those of us in Britain who are reasonably well off can, you know, support the teachings more generally. Our support for teachers allows them to teach in other areas of the world where people might have more limited resources. So it's really a support for the teachings in general, and just allowing the teachings to continue and really kind of caring for them and nurturing them and making sure that they continue. And then finally, I think for ourselves, there's an invitation to sort of see how it feels to be generous. I think we ask ourselves sometimes, how do we take our practice off the cushion? And one of the ways we can do that is to see how opening up our hearts and being generous can help us perhaps foster a bit of a wider sense of community, a bit of a wider sense of connection to others, and certainly the importance of our sangha here in Cambridge. So all of those are things that I would invite you to consider. Please be as generous as you can, because it's a very important part of the day, as I said. Also, we just have a little bit of a time factor because there's a taxi coming shortly. So if you could make that the next thing that you do, if you could take care of the Dana so that we can send Stephen on his way. And then we'll see you all downstairs for a cup of coffee. Sorry, a cup of tea. I don't think there's any coffee, but there might be. Anyway, thanks again so much for coming, and thank you again to Stephen, and we wish you well.
The trouble is when you worry about it, then